Welcome to April 2023's call. As always, keep yourself muted. When I say, do you have any questions, just raise your hand, or don't raise your hand, sorry, just unmute yourself and start talking. That's one of the nice things about when we don't have that many live people on the calls, you get to do that. And please take advantage of that. If you want to be in the hot seat, or if you actually want to ask a question while we're in the session, then please do. I was submitted 4 questions before our call tonight. And a lot of them are like a 3-part series question. So we have lots to get through. If you did submit a question, know that I'm doing them. If you submitted it a month ago, it's probably going to be towards the end. So this is just how I put them in my database. So let's get started. Here's the first question. I especially find the time spent in guided processes that you lead useful, as it gets me out of my thinking about stuff and is good time spent actually doing and practicing. Okay. Thank you. I love that this was a feedback, because then I'll know to do more of it. Can we do that as a regular part of the meeting? Yes, absolutely. We can do that. Here's the question. What are ways to anchor this approach more fully so that it becomes more of a natural part of how I respond to the rough and tumble of the day? And I think that what this person means by approach, just feeling your emotions. How can I anchor feeling my emotions more fully so that it becomes a natural part of how I respond to my difficult days sometimes? I suppose the question is, along with setting time aside to practice, what are your thoughts and suggestions for strategies for remembering to be more present in the heat of the moment? Setting time aside to practice is what this person asked. What are my suggestions? Well, it's easy for me to be with radical authenticity, being my innate driver, my number one. It's easy for me to just be in flow with my emotions. This practice comes a lot easier for me than I think most people. And that's what happened during my ski career that I didn't even know was happening. I'm also an Enneagram 8. Now, if you don't know what that means, there's this thing called the Enneagram. Write this down. Enneagram. It's a personality profile. There are 9 different types. And go online, find any test that is about the Enneagram and take a bunch of questions, answering a bunch of questions. Don't need to pay for anything. And then it'll give you a suggestion of what your top possibilities for your Enneagram type is. Do not assume that the test shows you what your Enneagram type is. Then read up on your top, say, 3 prospects, and then figure out what yours is. This is actually really, really important. Sorry, I'm going to turn my phone off. Sorry, guys. So find out what your Enneagram type is. Let me just decline this. And this will give you a lot of information more in a bit about this. So because I'm all about radical authenticity, it's really easy for me to just feel my emotions and be in flow with them. I'm also an Enneagram type 8. And what that means is that I have no filter. That's kind of the primary way that Enneagram 8s show up in the world, meaning I have a thought, I have a feeling, and I just feel it and I just speak it. Now, this does get me in trouble, but I think when it comes to being in flow with your emotions, it's actually very helpful. So first of all, I suggest that all of you that are on these calls, you're obviously here because you want to learn how to be more in flow with your emotions. I suggest that you figure out what your Enneagram type is. Here's why it's important, because let's say you're an Enneagram type 9. Now, 9s are typically conflict avoidant. They're not typically, they are conflict avoidant, and they're all about harmony. So they tend to deny fear or anger its rightful place in their lives. And so for 9s, it comes as a surprise if they have learned that they've been suppressing fear. And it takes a while for them to come to terms with the fact that they've been suppressing fear. So it might take 9s a little bit longer to be in flow with their emotions. 7s, which are kind of play junkies, they like to keep things on the surface. They're the type of people that are going to be ski bums or travel junkies. Everyone in Park City or Aspen, they're all sevens, right? Either they won't admit, the ski bums are not necessarily the high achievers that retired there. They are probably more threes, but the sevens either won't admit that they have any fear, or they tend to enjoy fear and they have a lot of fun with it. And so depends on how you're showing up as a seven. Sixes tend to overreact and feel more fear when they're stressed out than most people. So they're going to just have a lot more fear than everybody else. Fours, their core wound, which is tied to core fear, is the center of the universe. And so they're also going to have a lot more fear. So the first hot tip that I'm giving you on this is to get to know your Enneagram type first. If you want to be more in flow with your emotions just naturally, and you don't have to remember to do this kind of stuff, get to know your Enneagram type. And then based on that, learn your patterns, read up on your Enneagram type. Don't pay for results or any of that. You might want to buy a book. The Wisdom of the Enneagram is my favorite book on this, but learn your patterns as it relates to fear. Learn your patterns of what your greatest fears are. Read up on yourself, basically. Get to know yourself better. This is always a good idea for anything. And then also get to know, this is also a hot tip, get to know your patterns on other things. Like, oh, I get angry when I'm hungry. I get hangry, right? I call it owning your shit practice. Like getting to know that, oh, when I have my period, I want sugar. Or when I'm stressed out, I pick fights. Or, you know, fill in the blank is a million of these that we have, our shit patterns. Get to know your own, your shit patterns. All this is step one, get to know yourself. And step two is very important. Know that it's not about changing those patterns. This is not about controlling anything. This is only about noticing your patterns and being aware of them. Like, hey, I've been ignoring fear again, which causes it then, of course, host kink to show up in weird, wacky ways. As for the rest, maybe the third hot tip is the more you practice anything, of course, the better you get at it. The more you practice feeling your fear by using the four-step art of fear method, the more feeling it just becomes innate. It's like that with anything. Anything that you practice is just going to become more innate. But it's important that you have right practice, because if you're practicing the wrong golf swing for 10 years, right? That's going to become very ingrained and hard to undo. So that's why I'm here to help you every month, is to make sure that you're practicing this in the proper way. And more on that later. And then the proper way is what then becomes innate. So again, first hot tip to make this intuitive when you're having a shit hits the fan day, you know, get to know your patterns about who you are as a person, that you were born this way. Also, innate drivers, which I used to call core values. Number two, don't try to change these things. Don't, if you're a lamb, don't try to be a tiger. If you're a tiger, don't try to be a lamb. Just notice, right? Notice what your patterns are. Notice who you are. And then the third step is just feel and practice feeling. Now, as for practicing the four steps, I get that it's super hard to do for some people. Like, I want to do 20 pushups a day. I have this list of things that I want to do every day. And do I do those 20 pushups a day? No. Right? So how does one motivate to do something that they know they should do, but they just kind of forget about it, or they don't really want to do it? And the answer is, I have no idea. I was talking to Michael about this yesterday, actually. Like, I look at people who eat right, who exercise daily, who have a great morning routine. And I'm like, who are these people? You know, what a bunch of assholes, right? Just do your best and keep coming to these talks and just keep reminding yourself, you know, that this is what we want. And I love that the person that asked this question wants me to have us practice this together. And maybe if we only practice this once a month, I'll tell you what, that has a huge effect on our lives. And so, yes, we can keep reminding ourselves. And yes, I will facilitate the four steps in some version every month as well. And just step by step, hopefully we'll get there. Let's do it now, actually. Does anybody want to be in the hot seat and be facilitated in the four steps right now? And you don't have to. So Veronica, You don't need to raise your hand. Just unmute yourself and start talking. Boom.
All right, cool. We'll see. Even though it wasn't me who sent the question, but we'll take a stab at it.
Okay. So give me one sentence, because the story doesn't matter on anything. Just give me one sentence on something that is a pattern that you're in that's troubling you, or that you're feeling crummy, pain, anything.
I can feel afraid of my own thoughts and the results and the power I give my own thoughts.
Okay. I mean, right there, I immediately see, I'm always being a wordsmith, a writer, voice dialogue facilitator, just that language, the power I'm giving my own thoughts. That suggests, like, here's your thoughts, right? And I know you can't see me, but I'm holding up my hand next to me. And so I'm me, you're you, you're Veronica, and you have thoughts, and you're like, I'm not going to give that son of a bitch any power. And immediately you have conflict with that person in your head. Mm. And you definitely don't want to have conflict with that person in your head.
Yes. Right.
Right. So the issue isn't the thoughts. The issue is your conflict with the thoughts, or your resistance to the thoughts, or wanting them to be different.
The beliefs to that thought of what I feel, that belief that they have power. Yeah, exactly.
Well, they do have power. Of course they do. I don't think there's anything more powerful than our emotions and our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds to me like you're buying into some sort of self-help, course that maybe you've taken or heard about, where you're like, I'm not going to let my thoughts take control of my life. I'm going to take control of my thoughts. And that, that approach to thoughts is what, gives it magical powers. And next thing you're devoting your life to fighting a war against your thoughts.
Yeah.
All right. So we could do the four steps around your fear over thoughts controlling your life. We could do the four steps around your thoughts in general.
Let's do around my thoughts in general.
Okay. All right.
Let's see.
Because when I first created the four-step art of fear method, I created it to deal with fear. But the big aha I had years ago is that this is great for thoughts as well. So first of all, acknowledge that it's normal and natural to have a racing mind, lots of thoughts. It's not a sign of personal weakness. You're not like the person in the world that is, has racing thoughts, like all of us. That's just how our minds work. And I facilitate voice dialogue, which I've never done really with you, but I've talked to that crazy brain or that monkey mind or the noise in my head. We've called it a lot of different things. And trust me, it does not like being controlled. And if you try to control, it's going to rebel and be pissed off and fight back and take over.
Oh, yes.
So just notice that it's normal and natural to have that part of you be kind of crazy and off the rails, especially if you've been trying to control it.
Mm.
That's step one.
Yeah.
All right. And everybody do this too. Step two, I then want you to close your eyes if it helps. And everybody do this. I want you to just notice the thoughts in your head. And maybe they're not racing right now, but maybe they were earlier today, or maybe they were last week, or maybe they were last night. And just notice them. How strong are they right now? Veronica, how strong on a scale of 1 to 10 would you say?
My thoughts are strong, but they're like calm. Like I don't have anything particular in my mind. Like I don't have anything troubling me right now. So I just sort of acknowledge and notice that I've thoughts in my mind, but that's it. If that answers your question.
Right. So the mind isn't troubled right now. It's just doing whatever it's doing, but it's not on 11 because there's something that's upsetting you or it. All right. So no big deal. Step three is where, step three is always my favorite. It's always the most nuanced. What is your relationship with your mind? And I kind of just called you on it, didn't I?
It's better. Because, I've been, really, trying to adopt and, your, method of how, how to best, be friends with fear, for example, and to not feel so shitty about my mind and my thoughts and think that it's, an illness or, you know, from like, say, before with mental health, or that something's wrong with it, or something off with wrong with my thoughts, or that they're hurting me and all these sorts of things. It is better now, but it does take that self-work.
Yeah, I'm like a boxer looking for the openings. And I just heard you say it's not as shitty as it used to be, something along those lines. So just sit in step three, just feeling into, all right, my relationship is not as shitty as it used to be.
I'm trying to be optimistic here.
Right. Just feel into that.
Yeah.
Really come to terms with that thought, my relationship with this, I call the above the neck department, is not as shitty as it used to be. And everybody is probably having a different experience. We don't need to talk about it. Just feel into the feeling of that and have the thought. Just 10 more seconds. Now the fourth step, with feelings, like emotions. People ask what the difference between emotions and feelings are, and this is how I describe it. The emotion is just the emotion. It just comes from wherever it comes from. And our feeling is when our mind gets involved and then we have a thought about it. You know, how do I feel about these emotions? And so when we do the fourth step, I usually, if it's an emotional trouble, then we just want to spend some time feeling the emotion. But with thoughts, it's more about either being the thoughts or witnessing them, you know, two choices. If I can't sleep in the middle of the night, actually at 5 a.m. I woke up and my mind was just racing and I just observed it. So you can either be subject object observing it, or you can actually be the thoughts. So your choice, just 30 seconds, close your eyes if it helps. Just either observe subject object or be. This is classic meditation, just observing. There's no goals. This is classic Eastern meditation. What was that like for you, Veronica?
For me, I tend to be I was in the position of being my thoughts and how, just feeling them out, feeling their presence. That's the stage I'm at, at least. And just, well, acknowledging that unless if something is troubling me or my mind, then they are at peace. So, you know, and that's why this has been all big lessons for me to stop resisting both fear and my emotions and also my thoughts with that as well. So that's kind of where I'm at, I would say.
Yeah. And it's really a lovely moment too. And just one little language tweak. This is not about stopping resisting. My favorite analogy is skiing. Of course, it's not about when you're skiing the trees, not hitting the trees. Like you know, it's not about stopping anything. It's more about, because that suggests that we might wind up being in resistance to resistance, or we don't want to resistance shame ourselves. We've been fear shaming or thought shaming, but now we are resistance shaming. So it's about more just being in flow with whatever it is that shows up. And in skiing, looking for the open spaces, it's having an open experience. In the Japanese language, the word heaven is translated as spaciousness. And the word hell is translated as no space. And so when we have space in our lives for our thoughts, for our feelings, for our emotions, for our bad moods, all of that, then we're living in heaven. But if we have no space for these things, then we're living in hell. And so just a little subtle tweak of language there. If there's anything else you want to say, let me know. If there's anybody else that wants to speak, just unmute yourself and chime in. All right, let's move on. And that's what's being called in the hot seat. And I really encourage you guys to volunteer to be in the hot seat too and reveal yourself in these calls. Thank you, Veronica, for being willing to do that. Next question. How is flow and core values related? When our core needs are met, how do we get into flow? When our core needs are met, how do we get into flow? Stephen Kotler in his book wrote some universal triggers that get people into flow, risk-taking, immediate feedback, novelty. Are some triggers more powerful for some people and other triggers more powerful for others? So just to repeat what he said, Stephen Kotler talks about risk-taking, immediate feedback, novelty as being triggers. He called these universal triggers to get into flow. And I actually I need to call him about that. Anyway, question continues. Could you share what you do personally to be more in flow when you work? So this is kind of two questions. All right, Stephen and I are great friends. He's a risk taker. He's probably an Enneagram 7 and he loves feeling fear. So for him, he needs risk to get into flow. He also likely has the value of novelty. So again, he needs novelty to be in flow. And are you beginning to see the correlation? But that doesn't mean that's what you need or what I need. I mean, I do. I don't need novelty. I need risk. I need fear. I don't need it. Not anymore. But I did need it during my ski career before I knew about this stuff. You know, also before I knew about core values, which I'm now calling innate drivers, and I'm trying to make that transition. Whenever anybody asked me back in the day during my ski career what the secret to great skiing is, which is the same as asking what is the secret to flow, I always answered radical self-expression. Right? That's what it takes to ski the way I ski or to be in flow like I'm in flow. And in my ski camps, I used to teach that, but I realize now that is only what I need to get into flow because it was my innate driver. Radical authenticity presented for me in my ski career as radical self-expression. And sometimes your innate drivers can change or morph over time. Like Donnie's number one is workability. Sometimes it's order, sometimes it's control, but ultimately it is workability, but it can manifest in different ways at different times in your life. And that's what happened with me. Radical authenticity expressed as radical self-expression during my ski career. And so that was what I thought it took. And it was very external too, which worked great for skiing because great skiing is so out in front of us, like two turns ahead. And radical self-expression was a way for me to take radical authenticity, which was more internal, and to make it external, like the expression of that internal authenticity. And that's what worked for me. And I realize now it was very irresponsible for me to teach that as a way for others to get into flow states, which I did for over 10 years, because not everyone is like me. Everyone's different. Everybody cares about different things. For example, if someone's innate core driver is peace or serenity, flow states for them should definitely not include risk or saying yes to fear. I used to just try to get people to take more risks, you know, step out of your comfort zone. That'll get you what you want. Not necessarily. You know, that works for Stephen and that works for me, but not for these folks that I mentioned with peace or calm or, you know. For these folks, flow states come instead from having intimacy. There's the magic word. Remember that word. You hear me talk about it all the time. Intimacy with their peace or with their serenity, like while gardening, or maybe I've been watching these videos lately of people that, women in particular, that snuggle with a cow that has been abused. You know, it's a new thing. You got to look it up. It's so cool. Just hugging a cow, because I guess cows are very sensitive and very healing, and it's very healing to the person. So for that person, that's their flow state triggers, cuddling up with a cow that's been abused. So back to the question, what are the triggers that result in a flow state? It's just by going in an intimate way into the inside of the internal or perhaps external experience that you are having. Now, voice dialogue, which I would say half the people that have signed up for these calls have experienced with me. When you work with me one-on-one or when you work with me live, I will facilitate voice dialogue. I don't do that on these calls. Every once in a while, you'll hear me talk about it, or I'll say shift into the voice of or shift into the reality of. This is what I do live. I pretty much only facilitate voice dialogue when I work with groups live. So just do the best you can with this when I facilitate this on the calls. But if you just shift into an intimate experience with whatever matters to you, you're there in an instant. Like, I have a new boyfriend and it's been about 2 months, and we kiss and the whole world drops off for me by me just shifting into the intimacy of that moment. Now, he's a professional musician. I am a former professional athlete. You know what also I teach. So he also knows how to go there in an instant too. And radical authenticity is there for me. Radical authenticity is the love that I feel for him. Consideration is also there, which is another word for caring, which connects me to the moment and to him. And yes, there's an immediate flow state, like time just stands still. You know, I don't even exist anymore. It's like all those things that Stephen writes about in his book happens. And yes, fear is involved. It's always there, you know, in almost everything we do. Plus, it's a new relationship. So vulnerability is also there, which is pretty much fear. Or rather, vulnerability is a willingness to keep our hearts open when feeling fear. And you really have to be willing to be vulnerable to be in a new relationship with a stranger, you know, before you even know who this person is. But the key word in all of this, though, is intimacy. And maybe I'm trying on other words, but for now, what I've been teaching is flow equals, like, suffering equals discomfort times resistance. That's the opposite of flow. Resistance is the opposite of flow. Flow equals whatever you're feeling or doing or experiencing internally, externally, whatever you're in contact with, the cow, you know, times intimacy. And then you'll be in a flow state. So backing up, just ask yourself, first of all, what is your jam? What is my jam? Is it novelty or is it risk, like with Stephen? And add in intimacy to the either internal or external experience, and voila, you have a flow state of peace or creativity. Creativity is a big innate driver for people. If that's your jam, add in intimacy, and again, you will have a flow state. So maybe the equation is whatever you're into, you know, this is a better equation, whatever you're into, times intimacy equals flow state. Now let's take the second half of his question. Could you share what you do personally to spend more time in flow when you work? So I don't work as a skier anymore. Today I work, you know, preparing for this call, for example. You know, like today, when I looked at these questions, I started typing and going into the inside of each question and going really internal and feeling into them. And you do this I call it going into the inside of the face of, but I do a lot of voice dialogue. So that may confuse you, but I go into the inside of the face of the person who asked this question or the question itself. And when I do this, it feels like the universe flows through me and the answers come. And And that intimacy with the question, intimacy with the universe, intimacy with the person who asked the question is what connects me to the universe. And, you know, to get there, sometimes I talk about this, but this is very interesting. When I teach or when I try to answer these questions, look at my process as being like a triangle. It's like on the lower corner, you know, is me, Kristen, you know, and all my innate drivers and my emotions and, you know, what I teach in the relative reality. But then on the other side is the universe or the river or the infinite wisdom or what have you, like a spiritual place. And then I, to get to the place where I'm in a connected space, you know, I go to the conscious apex, the top of the triangle that includes and embraces both. So I'm human on this side, beingness on this side. I'm a human being up here. And then I'm trying to answer the question. And so my final answer basically to this question is that it's kind of one part intimacy with my Christianness. And this is how I get it to the answers. And this is, again, answers the question of how I get to a flow state when I'm working, when I'm writing, when I'm teaching, when I'm, you know, what have you. It's one part intimacy with my Christianness and one part intimacy with universal wisdom on the other side, you know, and so I'm in this space and I'm just free flowing through it all. And then I notice the second I get maybe uncomfortable, like my chair starts to bug me or notice the room around me or a phone call, you know, comes in, then I'm out, right? I go take a break. It can get pretty intense though, because I remember one time I was working on a magazine article and I was in my basement apartment and I had this terrible toaster that wouldn't pop up the toast and it would just catch on fire. And I had to watch it like a hawk. And so I put the toast down and I'm like, okay, I need to remember to come back in a minute, get the toast. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to edit that one sentence. And I go into my computer and I edit the one sentence. And then that led to me editing the paragraph. And then that editing to me led to me editing the section and I'm just all in it. And at one point I couldn't see the screen anymore because there was so much smoke. And, you know, that's how much I get lost in this stuff and how intense it can be when you have intimacy with the words. And if you read about writers, you know, that's what happens. They go on the inside of the experience that they're capturing on screen. And it wasn't until I literally couldn't see the screen. I mean, the place reeked of burnt toast. The kitchen was on fire, right? Like, that's what I'm talking about with a flow state and what comes from the intimacy. I had to remodel the kitchen and I think I kept the toaster, but anyway, that's another story. So what happened there that day? And intimacy, I actually finally looked up this word in Webster's dictionary, just before the call, and it's defined as closeness. And I thought, oh God, closeness? No, that doesn't even begin to capture it. And then I thought, well, maybe is it more about eroticism? And I then thesaurus and I looked up eroticism in Webster's dictionary, and it does, and it's all about sexuality and all that. And I don't mean sexual either. It's being on the inside of the face of, like I said. And I swear there's a word that's missing in the English language. There's a better word for erotic. There's a better word for intimacy. If you guys can come up with one, I'd love to hear it. The word that captures when you're completely immersing yourself in writing or hugging the cow or petting the cat or feeling the wind on your face or doing the dangerous thing that Stephen likes to do that I don't like to do anymore, where you're completely usurped by the moment, internally and externally. And here's the thing, this can happen through voice dialogue for me with a simple shift. I used to do it as a skier by smacking my poles together, 3, 2, 1, go, smack. And you see athletes do this all the time where you just shift and you're fricking there. So anybody have any suggestions for a better word than eroticism or intimacy? And or anybody have any questions before we do a little bit of an exercise?
I don't know if this is a word. I just thought of emaciated, but I don't know if that already exists.
Spell it.
emaciated, maybe like I am emaciated, S-I-A-T-E-D.
Okay, I'll look it up.
I feel like it could be similar to something. Emaciated.
Initiated. Initiated. Okay. Any other questions or suggestions for words?
Hi. I would say the word is embody.
I like that.
You become it.
Like physically embody.
Yes. Mentally, yeah. Physically.
Flow equals whatever you're doing or feeling times embodiment.
There's probably a religious word like transmigration or something, but despite my last name, I know nothing about that stuff.
I actually sent it as a question to my friend Mark Gaffney, who writes books on eroticism. He wrote The Erotic and the Holy, and I will let you know if he gets back to me and comes up with he probably has some Hebrew word, or I think the word needs to be not in the English language. I don't think it exists in English language. Complete immersion in the infinite. Immersion. I don't know if that's it either. I don't know. We will keep working on this as a group. But let's do a little exercise. Let's do a voice dialogue exercise. Those of you that have not studied with me in person and have not been facilitated in voice dialogue, this just do the best that you can. And this is not about trying to understand anything. This is not about faking or pretending to be anything. This is just about moving out of the way of this reality that I'm asking to speak to and letting it take over your body. And I call it voices. Just shift. I don't want to call it a voice though. Just shift into this moment. So basically, you are no longer Liz. You are no longer Veronica. You are no longer Michael or Ed or any of that. You've gotten out of the way of this reality and just have this moment take over your brain, your heart, your limbs, your skin, and just be this moment. It's not you being this moment. It's just this moment. That's all that exists. Close your eyes. Embody this moment. Seconds. Now embody. Every planet makes a sound, and the sound that the planet Earth makes is Om. And we can become Om, embody Om, or call yourself the sounds of the world, sounds of planet Earth. Let's do 30 seconds. Don't try to understand what this means, just become. Not even become, just be. Om, sounds of the world. It's no longer you hearing the sounds, it's about you being the sounds. You as you no longer exist. You as the sound are all that's here. bringing us back. I mean, this would be a good place to stop, but I should have left this question to the end. It's beautiful, isn't it? And only you know if you're in micro flow or macro flow. You know, if you're like 1% inside the face of these sounds, you become them, you embody them. You don't exist anymore as a person. It's just that experience. Even if it's 1%, that's micro, or even 0.0001%, that's a micro flow moment. But if you're 100%, that's macro flow. And it comes with a simple shift. Like, flow is never far away. It doesn't happen just at random. We can actually become it in an instant by doing what I just facilitated. And so, as to not take us out of this moment, let me not let you ask questions before I move on to the next question that was submitted. And stay in this place as we continue our Tuesday call. Here's the next question. I want you to chat about this payoff for an emotion sticking around. The payoff is, it keeps me in a relationship with something in my past that was important to me. So basically, emotion sticking around has kept this person in a relationship with something, somebody from their past, as it turns out. I asked actually for clarifying information, and the person that submitted this question says, well, how do I deal with the loss of a loved one and clinging to what was versus moving on joyfully? Again, I asked for more details, and she mentioned that her ex-spouse took their life by suicide, which made her sad. And knowing this person that she cared about was hurting and was not able to be there for them, not knowing what he was going through, has been really painful for her. And it's been hard. She feels like she's, the emotion of sadness is keeping her tied to this relationship in the past because it was important, rather than moving on joyfully. All right. So I love this question. It was interesting. And I first want to, so she's stuck, basically. She wants joy, but she's stuck in sadness. I first want to explore the word joyfully. The person who asked this wants to move on to being joyful. And this begs, of course, what about the death by suicide of a former husband or wife or anyone, or some sort of trauma from the past? How could it ever, or should it ever, result in joy? And maybe this person that asked this question is feeling a little misunderstood right now, but hear me out. There's two possible things going on here based on this question. Either what we're witnessing is an unrealistic approach to life and death, that it should be about joy, where even suicide should somehow eventually result in joy, which could possibly be the result of what I call the chirpy self-help movement that is trying to promote positivity, you know, rah, rah, at all, about all things at all costs. Like, remember the good times, you know, choose joy for what they brought us when they were alive. And we see this in we no longer call them funerals where we mourn the loss of this person. We now call it celebration of this person's life, and which is such a Western thing. And frankly, to me, it's nice, but it's also kind of bizarre and somewhat annoying. Like, can we please just be sad first? And maybe it's okay because the celebration of life sometimes comes a couple of years later after the person dies, in which case I think it's appropriate. But if it happens right away, like, can't we just be sad first? And for some people, it's going to take a while. And of course, though, said the person for whom radical authenticity means everything, you know, and matters most of all. And of course, that's going to be my first reaction. Like, where's the room for sadness to exist in this conversation? And of course, whatever you resist persists, right? So I think, okay, if sadness is lingering, it's because we're trying to rush to positivity too fast. You know, that's why it's still here. Or this person asked this question, and maybe perhaps their mind hasn't been hijacked by the positivity at all cost crowd, and instead their innate driver in life is happiness or joy, and they want to find the thing that's most precious to them. So it's not, I can't ever answer any of these questions one size fits all, because everyone's so different. So for me, I would never try to get to joy. I would just sit with the sadness and 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 sit with the sadness until one day, all of a sudden I don't need to do it anymore. And it's just kind of gone and I've moved on. But for the person who asked this, if it's the latter and joy is your jam, your innate driver, right? What's going to happen is that joy is just going to organically happen over time because that's just who you are. You'll get back to joy about your ex memories, just like the memory of your ex, just like a cat will come around back to being a cat pretty quickly, and a love bug will be a love bug. And, you know, so it's the former. If it's the latter and that's your jam, it's just going to happen, right? You will just come back to that organically. If it's the former though, and maybe that's why you're asking the question, maybe it's a combination of both. Maybe joy is your jam, but you're just kind of not getting there and you're stuck in this loop. Then probably you've had your mind hijacked by choose love, choose joy. You haven't spent enough time with your sadness. And just to answer this question for other people too, that think that they should move on from difficulties like this super fast, let me tell you about the hijacking that comes within the self-help community. And it may look like I have a chip on my shoulder about that self-help, you know, positivity community. And the answer is I definitely do, but mostly because I, for different reasons, I just need their help. I just need their help to get people to stop spiritually bypassing. And so I, you know, I remain very, very firm about this because it really has to be one or the other. Either you sit in your sadness or you move to joy as fast as possible, or you sit in your anger or you forgive as fast as possible. And forgiveness right now, by the way, is being challenged by a lot of people. A lot of celebrities, actually. What's the singer that just challenged? Taylor Swift actually just put something on Instagram about how this whole forgiveness thing is kind of bullshit. Look it up if you want. But so it is correcting, you know, but this self-help community, still there's a lot of talk about that in that world about anxiety, AKA fear. I'm just going to call it fear, or in this case, sadness. And they talk about it sticking around because your mind is dwelling on the past. They also talk about your mind projecting on the future, and that the solution in this chirpy self-help world is to be in the present moment. Lots of talk about being in the present, being in the present, being in the present. And I love that. I just facilitated that, right? However, I've talked to the mind and it doesn't want to be controlled like that. It's going to think about the past. It's going to noodle in the future. It just does whatever it's going to do. It also judges things as good or bad. And you can no more stop that process than you can stop the rotation of the earth. So when you're feeling sad about something in your past, just when it comes up, of course, you know what I'm going to say, just be sad. Indulge that sadness or fear or whatever it is that connects you to your past. Now, especially if connection is an innate driver, I should mention, you should do this. You know, you want to connect to the sadness because the sadness is the only connection you have with your ex-husband. Or you want to connect with the anger because it's the only connection you have to keeping yourself safe or righting a wrong. And it's the only connection you have to your soul. If love is your innate driver, you know, can you find a way to love your sadness? Because if you love your sadness and that's all you have left of your ex-husband, it's you loving your ex-husband. Or caring. Caring is an innate driver. You know, can you care about your feelings and emotions? And if so, then you're satisfying who you are and what you're here, what your jam is on earth. It's just to sit in a caring place for somebody that you loved that died. So let's do that now. Let's all do that, actually. I want you to think about something or someone in your past that makes you sad, maybe a breakup, a death of a friend. You know, my dad he just had a really difficult life, and I just feel sad for him. My mom just broke her other hip 2 days ago. I could go there. But take away the story. And I mentioned that doing the four steps is about doing them right. So take away the story. And this is a really big lesson for this. As the story and the emotion can be tied together, but the emotion no longer exists in the past. It only exists right now. So if it's fear, if it's sadness, whatever it is, I want you to just feel it. And when you leave the story out of it, when you just feel the emotion itself and not noodle on the story, you may realize the story or the person or the situation, this is a big point, that triggered the emotion may have nothing to do anymore with the emotion itself as it exists today. So right now, for 1 minute, close your eyes if it helps. We're just doing the fourth step on sadness. Just feel the emotion of sadness for 1 minute and notice what comes up for you. And again, no story, just feel into the emotion. And some story may come up. It may be tied to something else entirely. You know, what warranted the sadness that we've kind of drug up from a story in the past or even 2 days ago with my mother may not be what the sadness is that I feel right now. Close your eyes, 1 minute. Notice if it's sadness that you're feeling, or if it's sadness about the sadness. If so, that's resistance to the sadness, which can also show up. If so, just feel that. Notice whatever you notice. Bring in this moment or the sounds of the world. The self doesn't exist anymore, only the sadness. I'm noticing for me, it feels very personal. Like deep personal sadness. Not tied to anything. May even come from humanity-wide sadness. Like we explored last month. All the atrocities, all the sadness of the world for as long as humans have existed, all sentient beings, planet, all that, it lives within me. If you're crying, notice if that's the resistance to the sadness. If you have the thought, I hate this, or I wish that weren't so, then that's resistance to the sadness. And that's what you're feeling rather than the sadness itself. Open your eyes. Anybody want to talk about what came up for them?
I guess I should speak. The sadness isn't as strong as it used to be. And like you just said earlier about it organically, things, you know, evolving. So I'm accepting it. I don't feel so sad today through that practice. So there's glimmers of hope there.
Okay. This is a practice of accepting is level two. Resistance is level one. Accepting is level two. Level three is feeling. And level four is intimacy. But we may be looking for a new word for intimacy. But acceptance is definitely the first step in the right direction. But it's definitely not all the way. Like if this is my sadness sitting next to me and I accept it, that's not the same as feeling it and connecting with it in an intimate way. So see how far you can take this, Sue. And it could be a beautiful gift that you're left with. It's like it's a rude awakening when a friend commits suicide or when any kind of trauma happens. And the rude part is over. And now hopefully through feeling your emotions, the awakening comes. And when our loved ones die, the gift that they get the opportunity to really feel, you know, feel our sadness and feel our anger and our frustration and our just like pain. And it makes us feel so alive. I remember a friend of mine died kiteboarding and I was the first one on the scene besides the paramedics. And I had to tell his wife. And anyway, for 2 days, I just didn't leave the house, sat in stinky pajamas, watched TV, didn't feel like dealing with any of it. And then the third day I went outside to get the mail and it was a windy day. And, it was the wind that killed him, a gust of wind that was about 100 miles an hour while kiteboarding. And just the wind finally woke me up and I was ready to feel my sadness about what had happened. And it's like his wife was just so mad at me just by being a kiteboarder and being a friend of his that he hung out with to kiteboard. And it was super traumatic and she was rude. And I mean, what am I going to do? Like it was very intense situation internally and externally. And I just sat, I didn't get the mail. I just sat on the ground and I felt really profound sadness. And I don't think that year I'd felt that alive yet. And it's one of the few times in my life that I remember very poignantly. And so that's the gift that our friends offer us in the emotion that is left behind in us. You know, can we feel it and just completely submit to and become it and then feel more alive than we ever have in our life? Or do we go numb? It's beautiful practice. Once you really learn how to feel. Anybody else? Or Sue, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, but I can relate to your story about hibernating and you know, putting all my time into focusing in work or whatever to kind of just avoid that sitting in sadness. But, you know, with ski camp and this, I'm learning to sit with it. And, you know, there's glimmer of you know, things are getting better. So.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
It's a process, that's yes, for sure. So I have a quote for you guys that is a great transition for this last question and also to our last question. It's by Chuck Palahniuk, an American novelist. People fall so in love with their pain, they can't leave it behind. The same as the stories they tell, we trap ourselves. So that's the one caveat, is that we can really fall in love with our pain or our sadness as the only thing that connects us to, for me, my ex-husband, or for you know, maybe you, the death of ex-husband, and or any kind of whatever anybody on this call was feeling into with their sadness, you know, you just, if you get stuck in a loop, just know that you may be in love with it, and it can become an addiction, and a way to connect with that person. And it's a matter of just noticing. But let's see where we go with this last question. And I don't know that we're going to be able to go all the way with this last question. Let's see how far we get, because this is like a three-part question. One of the things I learned from you, in my own words, was to sit with my fear and anxiety. And of course, note, they are the same thing. And I'm going to refer to fear as fear instead of anxiety, more than likely. The place where I get stuck is I sit there too long. And of course, that goes back to our quote, you know, perhaps the person who asked this is in love with their anxiety, AKA fear, if that makes sense, she writes. And I don't know how to get out of it. I'm sure somewhere, and everything I've read of yours tells me how to do that. I don't know how to get out of it. This is what this person wants, to get out of it, but I can't seem to find the way out. I have stressed myself so much this year that I've ended up being sick for a couple of months with sinus issues and stomach issues and fatigue. I think this person is trying to say that the emotion or the stress is actually causing this, which is why it's part of the question. I'm trying to dig my way out. So again, we have, I want to get out of it. I want to dig my way out. So these two sentences right there is the problem, the language, you know, of trying to dig out or get out. And you guys know what I teach. You can see why I narrowed in on that language. How do I get out of it? How do I dig my way out? And it's like this person's being swallowed by their emotion. And then the swallowing of the emotion is causing these physical issues. And then the second question is, if you think it's of interest to the group, it is. My annoyance in dealing tactfully with slights amongst friends, which are huge things I'm all over, take personally and can't resist dissecting. Oh my gosh, I love this question. Basically noodling on people that have been rude to us, or right. The question that this person asked is, the best way to deal with this is to bring them to the surface or not. So basically deal with it or just kind of block it out. Let's get to the first part, the sensation usurping us and we can't get out. All right. So if the sensation doesn't run through you by sitting with it, then you either need to spend some more time with it, because it has a lot to say. Although these emotions, sadness, fear, I want to emphasize this again, they don't communicate with words or sentences or thoughts. Fear does not speak in sentences, does not speak in stories. And if it does, listen to my next explanation why, that means that you've kicked the hose. And anyway, it only communicates as sensation. Let me give you an example. Like when my book came out, I was very much ensconced in an abusive relationship and had been for quite some time, and I was miserable. I was trying to fully embody what I teach, because I'd just written a book about it, and I'm lecturing a lot about fear. And so I'm really feeling into my fear, and it's really kind of for the first time in my life, because I didn't always feel my fear during my ski career. I had a paradox going on. So for the first time in my life, when my book came out, when I was just the most miserable I've ever been, except for during my divorce, my fear, it would have been worse had COVID not been around, but I'm talking about, eventually I developed social anxiety. I didn't have to deal with that during COVID because there was no social events. But when my book came out, my fear, basically from childhood rejection, I figured out, and just not having any friends and a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, again, it doesn't really matter where it comes from, but it just showed up, my fear from childhood that I had learned to overcompensate for too much information, and which became rigid and tough and very masculine and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, resulted in a lot of injuries in skiing. I don't want to go too much further down that rabbit hole, but bottom line is, I was giving a lot of speeches, a lot of interviews, a lot of social engagements, and I found that I lost my ability when I was giving these speeches, interviews, or meeting with important people, that I couldn't breathe. And I was in it. I had social anxiety. And I was like certain that they could tell because I'm swallowing a lot. I can't breathe, you know, my mouth goes dry. And so I was so in it, you know, my undealt with fear. I just felt it and I felt it and I fell in love with it. You know, no story though. I didn't noodle on why it was there or anything. Like, you know, I don't teach, which was great. I just felt it and I felt it. I felt it. And I could have probably, if I had already come up with a 4-step art of fear method, dealt with it in probably a day or two, but I hadn't come up with a 4-step art of fear method. It's actually what made me come up with a 4-step art of fear method, just because the 4 steps work so fast, but I didn't have them yet. So eventually, you know, with what little time I had, I mean, I was working 100-hour work weeks, but I didn't put a lot of effort into it is what I'm trying to say. After 6 months though, it just went away on its own. All of a sudden one day I just noticed it wasn't there anymore. So again, it was just being in it and feeling it and being in it and feeling it and not having a practice on it, which I didn't do. It worked, but it took a while. And sometimes it comes back. Like when I'm with somebody and I want something from them. Usually I want them to like me, right? And I just feel it in that moment and it goes away and it doesn't come back. And that is really what's supposed to happen. You know, you don't get buried by it or you don't try to crawl your way out or anything. It's just, you just sit with it and eventually you're just out and you don't even, there was no effort that you put into it except for just feeling and being with it. Although sometimes it takes a while. And I don't know if that's what's going on here with the person that asked this question. Maybe there's just a lot there. Now, however, if it's not going away, and that means that I'm trying to resist the urge to say you're doing it wrong, right? But let me give you an analogy. It reminds me of a guy who buys a piece of exercise equipment and it sits in his garage for a while and he doesn't even put it together, you know, or he doesn't put it together properly. He doesn't use it. And then he sends it back saying it didn't work, right? It's kind of funny, right? Maybe a better analogy would be a dishwasher and it's put together properly and the person washes all the dishes but it's not installed properly. And he sends it back saying, this is a piece of junk. We have to install it properly. We have to actually use the tool properly and we have to use the tool period and we have to use it properly. And if you do this, the universe works great. If you connect with your fear or pain and it doesn't make it flow, the question I have then is what is the user error? And if you really are sitting and feeling your fear, AKA anxiety or sadness or whatever it is, here's the user error. You think you're feeling your fear, but likely you're not. A lot of people don't know what it means or what it feels like to feel their fear. They think that, okay, I'm thinking about feeling it. That's feeling it, but it's not feeling it. Thinking about feeling a cat is not feeling a cat. Or maybe thinking about things that you're afraid of. That's the worst. That's just being in your head, trying to understand something that you'll never be able to understand. That's not feeling your fear either. Or maybe talking about your fear with a friend or a therapist, that's also not feeling your fear. Here's the one that I suspect the person that submitted this question may be doing is that they're focusing on the fear. But focusing on the fear is also not feeling. Spending time with it, trying to understand it. Anytime the word try is there in the sentence, I'm trying to feel it, right? None of this is feeling it. So then the second part is add to this, if you're using it as a way to get it to calm down or go away or leave you alone or what have you, having that agenda is also, as I've mentioned a few times, not going to work. If your agenda, like if this is my fear, if my agenda is like, okay, I'm going to spend some time thinking about you or focusing on you as a way to get rid of you, you know, it is going to rebel and you're just going to be in this tug of war and it's never going to dissipate the way nature intended. So to illustrate the difference, I want everybody right now to, we're going to do this quick, to find their fear. Close their eyes and just find any kind of physical sensation of discomfort in your body. For me, it's showing up in kind of little subtle ear infections. And so notice if you're just focusing on a health concern, that's probably where you're going to find it. It will go to whatever place is your weakest link, if you're not dealing with it properly, to make itself known there. Now, wherever you found it, I want you to think about that feeling. This is not what I want you to do in the four steps or the fourth step. Now I want you to focus on it. Again, this is using your mind. This is not what I want you to do. And now I want you to connect with it as a way to get rid of it. Notice what that feels like. That's not what I want you to do either. Now let's move all of that out of the way. Now I just want you to feel it. No agenda, no goal, no mind, no thoughts, no trying to understand anything. Just feel it. For those of you that are doing it with an ache or pain, this is kind of my favorite party trick. Like if somebody has a headache or a toothache, like you find out very quickly what part of it is emotional, or what part of it is resistance to the pain, or what part of it is resistance to the emotion. You just feel it. Again, no goals. Capital letters, no goals, exclamation point. Just feel it. And you know when you get it right. I'm going to leave the stress making this person sick to the next call. And also the question of, when my friends piss me off, I mull over it, take it personally and start dissecting. I'm going to leave that for next month. Anybody have anything they want to share right now? Okay. Well, I guess then this is our call. And the one thing that comes from the four-step art of fear method is that I hope that we don't take ourselves so seriously anymore. And I hope that anything that upsets us or results in fear or pain or sadness back to the rude awakening, there's always the rude part. And this work is where the awakening comes from. Notice what kind of insights we have when we do this practice and when we just feel into our emotions. And that's it. Thanks for joining me. And I'll talk to you guys next Tuesday. Submit questions and also submit if you would like to be in the hot seat for anything, in which case I will facilitate you maybe in voice dialogue or maybe in the four steps. That's it. Bowing. Thank you.